Oh, thank you for coming on, and it's good to have you here. I did give you a bit of warning before this that my cricket knowledge is very, very minimal, and I
Okay.
think growing up in Scotland, like we don't have the same exposure to cricket as you have in England, where I live now. But I've always had an interest in just professional sport in general. Like that was actually my degree was in sports and business. So
Oh,
I've
that's great.
always I've always had a fascination for it. And then saw that you were interested in Bitcoin, and I was like, right, let's chat about that. So Matt, it's really good to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, pleasure. Pleasure to be here. Seeing your stuff.
That's great.
It's good. Education, right, is the way forward. I feel, there's a lot of misconceptions, let's say, about the space in general. Especially Bitcoin, with it just being for scammers and fraudsters and tax dodgers and stuff, but that's just simply not the case.
There's such a bad cloud over it from a lot of people, and the the narrative's shifting. But anyway, we will get on to Bitcoin at the end. Let's talk about, I'm really interested in like you being in cricket and like what that was like. So cricket, let's start at the beginning. Like, how did you get into it? Because it's harder for me to think about it, because growing up in Scotland, we don't see cricket at all.
Well, we actually play quite a few games up in Scotland, in Edinburgh at the Grange. It's called Grange Cricket. So Scotland, although they're a country, they actually joined the league, the Norwich Union League, which is Pro 40. It's basically so they were playing against county teams. So my team, Yorkshire, would go up there and play them, and they were part of the competition.
So I'm a football fan. So in football, it's like the Scottish Premier League joining the English Premier League.
No, it's like the Scottish national team joining the English Premier League. So obviously, if it was just a couple of teams, like say Rangers or whatever, they'd compete, but they'd struggle. Whereas if you put the Scottish national team in, it's basically, you're playing against better players, and it brings your game on quicker and to the standard that you need to be. And it helps Scotland quite a bit, to be fair. So the three teams were Ireland, Scotland, and the Netherlands. So they added them to the Netherlands were in, I think, the South group or North group. We only played them a couple of times. But Scotland and Ireland were in the North group. So we got a couple of beautiful trips away. Our team. But like mini stag do's that play a game of cricket in between. It wasn't as professional as what it is nowadays, but no, it was really good fun. Really good fun.
Because I do know someone that plays for the Scottish cricket team, but it's very niche. Like, if you're playing in Scotland, like, it's just not spoken about a lot.
It's an interesting cricket's a niche sport anyway, like unless you're from India or subcontinent or Australian. Those are, if you're, Europe, if you're European, it's all football, isn't it? Football, maybe golf, fishing.
It's massive. Like, it is a massive sport.
Fishing is actually the most participated sport on a Saturday afternoon during the summer.
Really?
It's out of any other sport. Bonkers when you think about it. But that's right, of
Wow.
course.
Right, let's stick on cricket then. Enough of fishing. How did you get into it? Like, growing up, were you just playing it at like the local team?
The school, obviously my school being a comprehensive a state school, didn't play cricket at all. So that's my high school. But it was before that I ever got into cricket. So my dad played for a local club, take us down on a Saturday afternoon, myself and my brother used to play at the side of the field while he was playing. And then we got on from there really and ended up playing for quite a few local teams and then getting picked up by the district, the local sort of, it was schools competition, even though my school didn't play. So it was a little bit weird. You sort of got put forward for a trial and then you got through that and then forward to the Yorkshire trials. And then
yeah,
I managed to enter the Yorkshire junior system when I was like seven. So when I was seven, I was playing for the Yorkshire under 11 schoolboy team. And then, yeah, just the natural progression through the school system, through the academy, into the reserve second team, and then into the first team. And then from there, and playing for England. So, you know, it's just sort of I followed the very typical natural progression of things. For all of the players, it's quite different. Obviously, when you progress at different times and you grow at different times, some guys, you know, don't sort of late bloomers don't start growing until they're like 15 and then have a big growth spurt. And, you know, that didn't really happen to me.
Yeah, just gradual, slow and steady.
Yeah.
What was it like? I can only imagine representing your country in the sport that you love. So like before this, I was watching some YouTube videos of you. And I'm going to highlight one is one of the commentators was just screaming like Bezzy lad.
Yeah.
You do a knee slide.
I know it's video. I don't know what a knee slide. I know it's video you're talking. That was actually a county game. So that was Yorkshire versus Lancashire in a T20. My England days were done by then. So the times of full stadiums and massive pressure and all that sort of big games, they only came around, you know, rarely. And Yorkshire Lancashire is one of those games. T20, packed house. Friday night at Headingley, it had been raining, like it was just perfect conditions for the knee slide, to be honest. When you ramped up, adrenaline's going and stuff like that, it's difficult to keep a lid on your emotions, let's say, especially when it's against the old enemy. So yeah, I pulled the knee slide out. I was probably, no, looking back now, I'm like, ooh, yeah. Someone did that.
Well, you would say in the interview after, I can't remember what it was, but you're like, yeah, don't know why I done that. Like, just like,
yeah, off in the moment. I'm 30 years old, I'm doing knee slides. But, I was captain as well, supposed to be setting an example.
Yeah. Oh, that's jokes. Yeah. It was very funny when I was watching that. So, what was it like sort of going to England now? Like, what was it like playing for England? And you won the Ashes, right?
Yeah.
And I won
the Ashes twice. I mean, it's like, it's all your boyhood dreams come true, really. And the first time you walk on the park is like, gives you a massive feeling of pride and accomplishment. But you know, that's just the first step. You know, it actually gets harder from that moment on, you know, to keep up with your peers but the accountability that you have in that situation, you know, it's not just 300, 400 cricketers that come in after your spot. It's, you know, it's 40,000 cricket, 50,000 cricketers maybe. There's a big sense of achievement, but the first time you walk on that ground it's obviously pride and, satisfaction, but then, you know, that's where the hard work starts. You know, you've got to keep hold of that spot and be consistent for years. Stay fit, stay healthy, stay humble. And you know, you just got to keep performing. Otherwise, that's it. It's brutal business. Brutal business.
I can imagine it's like what I can relate it to is football, like playing for. If you're playing for England, it's cutthroat, right?
If you don't
perform, then you're out.
Yeah.
You've been there for a long time. It feels like you kind of, even if you don't have a good season, you can still maintain your spot.
Exactly. I mean, the media nowadays, especially through social media, they have a massive say on selection. You might not think it, but that's exactly what happens. So it wasn't as bad when I first started, but towards the end of my England career, it was like, oh my God, like then it just ramps up. Like to be on social media is just, for want of a better word, you're kind of pissing into the wind a bit. You know, everything you tweet, you just get so much abuse from fans. But you're not talking just England fans, you know, you're talking fans from around the world who've got an interest in cricket. So it's an intense environment. You're sort of in a little bubble. You try and protect yourself away from it from as much as possible. But you think crypto Twitter is a harsh environment, and you know that there'll be times when crypto Twitter is just losing its mind, right? But yeah, I mean that's the same in any sport, really, especially high level sport. It's just no need to be on social media.
Like I'd never been a big fan of it, and I have to force myself to do it. Put stuff out there because you will get criticism wherever, from any side. Like it's such a different way of, like we were talking about this before we came on, of like growing up. It's such a different way of growing up because we just weren't used to that. And you didn't have that constant criticism on you all the time because you only had like the people around you.
Yeah.
And now it's like you've opened up to the whole world.
Correct. Like if you want to put stuff out there, you better, you know, you have to stand by it really. You know, you have to have conviction in what you're saying. Because there will be pushback. That's why my own kids and stuff, like I feel really sorry for them at times from the, you know, the environment that they've got to grow up in. It's like we were saying, it's 50, 60, sometimes percent online. Their relationships are online. It's tough for them. It's a lot different to when we grew up, and it's, you know, but you have to move with the times. Otherwise you get left behind, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And like that's a fit perfectly to what we are talking about, is like people having to keep up with times. You might not like it, but like that's the direction that the world's going in. So either you jump on the wave and you ride it, or you just sit behind and let everything progress, but you're just not keeping up with stuff.
You can't sound, can you? Like,
yeah,
life will pass you by.
Exactly. So you back to cricket. Sorry, we're gonna be a lot of this, like going off and then coming back. So you retired a couple years ago now?
Yeah, nearly 3 years ago now. The grand plan was always myself and my wife, like, right. Obviously cricket takes you to some unbelievable places, right? But you know, you're never really around your family that much. So my wife, and especially my firstborn, I missed quite a lot of his like from being born to about being 6 years old. Like I just wasn't around. I was always playing for England. So it's like,
how long were you away for? How long would you typically
Some years are worse than others. Like the worst year I had was actually the year he was born, actually. I spent 10 nights in my own bed. And that was like stealing a night and a day for a travel day in between maybe Manchester and Newcastle. Because obviously like there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that you don't see. Like obviously everyone just sees the games that are on TV, which, you know, that's a crazy schedule in itself. But then there's, you know, the recovery day, the travel day, the two practice days before that game even takes place. And that's just a one day series. If you took, if you look in Test cricket and played in India, you might head out there a month or so in advance to get acclimatized, like get used to the conditions. And then the actual test tour that you're playing might be 7 weeks, 7-8 weeks, for it might be 2 months. And then there'll be a one day series on the end of that. And then a couple of T20s just because, like, so you could be in India for 3.5 months, maybe, or 4 months. I remember once. So we flew to, we played the World Cup in India.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we flew out on like September. We played all the way up until Christmas. We flew on maybe for 3 days at Christmas. And then we flew back to India because we were playing a one day series and test series against India at that. So the World Cup was in India, and then we were in India for a test and one day series. I was there for like 5 months, 5.5 months I was in India. Yeah. And then we went straight to South Africa and then back to England for the English summer with, you know, maybe a 10 day break in between. And that was pretty much how the winters went. And yeah, you play a tour, you go somewhere, play a tour before Christmas, and then you come back. Maybe if you're lucky, if you're Australia, if we're Australia, they actually play a Boxing Day test. So does South Africa. So you have your Christmases away from home as well, and the family might come out and join you for a little bit, for a little while. Yeah, and most, obviously you can't play cricket in the winter in the UK. So yeah, you know, all the tours are from away, somewhere where it's sunny, which is a good thing. Yeah. I'm not saying bad thing. But yeah, like the winters, I'm just not used to the English winter, really.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's that. We're sort of off piste. Yeah, I retired in like 3 years ago, and then we just decided to go traveling, myself and my wife. That was always the plan whenever I retired. Let's go traveling. So we took the kids out of school, and we just decided to pick up and go and follow the sun for 19 months, I think we were away, all told. So yeah, we started in Cape Town, did the safaris, did that, and then drove up the east coast of South Africa all the way up to Johannesburg. Then it was getting a bit chilly, so we needed to keep going north. So we followed the sun. We went to Zimbabwe, did a full lap round Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and then it was just getting a bit cold there. So we missed out Kenya, which we really wanted to do, Kenya. And then we just flew to Egypt, and then from there we did the UAE, and then back into Europe. Pretty much most of Europe we ticked off. A lot of Greece, a couple of months in Greece, a couple of months in Croatia, Montenegro, Bosnia. Everywhere, dude. Like everywhere. I think of we managed to do. And then early October, November, we decided that it's like end of the summer, sort of European summer. So it's like, where's good? We could do a little bit of a base, in the Far East, maybe. And like looked at schools, looked at stuff. So decided on Bali. So we lived in Indonesia for 7 months and just used that as a little bit of a base. Put the kids in school a little bit, just to, you know, keep them fresh rather than us teaching them and stuff. But they were learning so much on a day-to-day basis. You know, just the things that we were doing instead of reading about the seven wonders of the world in books and stuff, we decided, you know, let's just go see it. Let's go show them with our, you know, see it with our own eyes and can learn about it while we're there. So it was incredible. Incredible.
I love that you were, just chasing the heat.
Yeah, chasing it.
Literally, like, yeah, because I don't handle the UK weather or the UK winter at all. Like, I went off to Mexico for 5 months, maybe 2 years ago, just because I can't bear the winters anymore.
Yeah.
I just had, I'd love to be able to just travel and like go to these places. And I love that you just took the whole family as well. The whole family went.
Yeah.
And how old were the kids?
When we set off, 9, 6, and 4.
So what was it, an easy decision taking them out of school and just being like, well, we are going to give you the education of life?
Yeah, I mean, we just saw it as what we were doing was the right thing to do. So yeah, it was a very easy decision. And when we talked to the school about it, and we're saying we're gonna go traveling. We're gonna go this place, and the school were great. Like the local authority were like, you've got to fill out this form. We need to know what you're doing from a safeguarding point of view. But the teachers at the school was like brilliant. Like, send us a postcard. Like, they're gonna learn this soon. You know, like they were fully supportive. Like, and it was brilliant from the school, from the teachers especially. A lot of them had traveled, so they were giving us tips and places to go and check it out. When if we were ever not close to this place, like, you've got to go check this out. You know, it was cool. Yeah, it was very cool.
Nice. And then you said you put them in school in Bali.
Yep. Bali, yeah.
Did they go to school any point in between that, or were they doing like any online classes or anything?
Yeah,
like
so
that?
We were effectively what is called world schooling. So we had a lot of like books and materials and learning stuff with us, as well as our like devices, where they had an online portal where we could log them in and stuff like that. But that was mainly for reading maths and just the basics. But they were doing so much reading, and like we were testing them along the way when it came to maths and stuff like that. So we were effectively world schooling them. So we'd pitch up to the Pantheon in, where is it? Athens. Okay. And like Max, my 9-year-old, we'd go right. Like all the information boards that are dotted around the place. Right, Max, that's you for today. You got to stand and read that. But he'd stand and read it, and there'd be a crowd that'd form and people reading it as well. And Max would be reading it out loud and stuff. And that is just a different experience, isn't it, than standing up in class and reading from a textbook? Like,
There are big presentations on it. You're actually standing in front of it and you're reading about it. It's such a better way of,
it's a different way of doing it. It's not necessarily a better way. I feel as though it is a better way. But obviously it's not accessible to everyone, and not everyone, you need a certain amount of conviction, because we did get a lot of pushback from friends and stuff. What are you doing? You can't take school. I'm like, oh, well, actually we can. Like, you get arrested. You know, there's people like, wow, it's crazy. We're crazy. We had a great time.
I feel like you're saying, like, some people think you're crazy doing that, but I referred to this actually in the last podcast I done as well, but I wrote something about like crazy is a numbers game, and like the more people think the same way, the less crazy it becomes. Yeah. And I feel like that's kind of happening in a lot of areas, just because we're going into this digital age.
Yeah.
But it's happening a lot in education, I would say anyway. There's long jobs, you don't need a university degree anymore. And that's massive. And it's just a different way of thinking, right?
Yeah. I mean, most of the way we processed it, they could get a traditional education, but at the end of the day, most of the jobs that they're going to be going for when they're old enough to get a job don't even exist yet, right?
Mm.
Like the way the world is moving, it's moving so quickly now. So how do you know what to teach them? And in my opinion, the English education system is, you know, ancient anyway, right? There's no way they can keep on top of the way and how quickly the world is moving. And you know, like you said, it's a very progressive thing. You have to keep on top of it. And what we did was, you know, what we thought was right at that time. And I don't think there is a right and a wrong when it comes to education. I just think I'd love the opportunity to learn like that. And obviously people have different learning styles and learn in different ways. You know, instead of Victoria Falls reading it in a book, or, you know, let's go zip line across it. So that's fun as well.
And you learn while you're there as well. Like, as you said, like, there'll be tours around these places and like absorb that information and you arguably you'll remember it a lot more because you've experienced it.
Correct. Like the memories we've got are just incredible. Most of them. Like we actually did a YouTube vlog. It was mainly for friends and family, but you know, people find it. It's the Breslin's on tour. So you can go on YouTube and check out what we did. And, you know, my wife, Hannah, she edited them together and like learning while she was doing it. So the first couple took for like forever, like to edit and get out there. But, you know, by the end, it was an hour and a half job to edit the week's worth of footage together. And yeah, we actually, it was getting quite stressful, you know, taking all the footage and stuff like that and uploading it. And I just, at that point, so we got about 6 or 7 weeks, maybe 12 weeks. And then we do 2 weeks at a time. And then I'm like, this is what we've done this month. But yeah, like just constantly taking footage was getting quite tough. So we just like, what are we doing? Like, I know we want to show what we're doing to friends and family back home, but actually we need to experience this as well without constantly looking behind a camera and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, we were learning on the way as well. So it's mainly just, we got pictures and videos of the kids just speaking. What did we do this week, guys? Oh, yeah, we went to, we saw an elephant fighting a lion. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Well, that is really cool. And it's, I know what you mean about having to video everything. And it's different when it's you as well. And there's a lot of people who like put everything up on Instagram. Like their food will come at the table and they'll have to take a picture before that. But I'm the sort of guy that would just like stab a fork in it and ruin it before everyone gets a bowl of it. So yeah, I'm more about like experiencing something rather than experiencing it. You're there, but you're experiencing it through a phone.
Yeah.
It's very,
I mean, part of the reason why you travel was to live in the present as well.
Yeah.
And we felt we were getting away from that. So yeah, the YouTube videos, they start off, this is week one, this is week two, this is week three, this is week four, this is week 5, 6, 7.
So what was it like when putting the kids in school in Bali, what was that like?
Well, first of all, we went to a neo-humanistic school, which
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. And we thought, right, well, let's get a different sort of perspective on education. So it was a very American, very Americanized idea. So they do yoga and gardening, how to look after animals, which in Bali there's a lot. In fact, the third week we were there, and at school, the a python got into the chicken coop. Well, it got in, but it couldn't get out because it was too fat. And it couldn't squeak out through the cage because it got this big chicken about it. So yeah, that was funny in a way. But yeah, like the school was great, and it was vegan, and it was this, that, and the other. It was just a different, totally different from what we're used to when it comes to education. But yeah, they had a curriculum as well where they do like English and maths and geography and stuff like that. But it's just a different way of doing things. And then we got an opening at the school. An international school, which was a British standard education. So we joined that one. But again, it was the British standard education where it came to reading and maths and geography, science, all that sort of stuff. But they also did the yoga and the outdoorsy stuff that you couldn't maybe experience in the UK, and the cultural stuff, like they do Balinese presentations. They were learning Bahasa. They were, so yeah, that was pretty cool. And they spent about 3 months, 4 months there.
Wow. It's totally different. Just, yeah, wherever you go. And we're just kind of used to how things are here.
Yeah.
Where you go somewhere else, you're like, oh, they're doing this completely different. And I kind of like it. That's very much the experience I had when I was at university. I'd done like a semester or whatever it's called in the Netherlands, and the cultural difference there was like, I was like, these guys love sport. Like, I'm getting to play sport way more, and I'm just way more active, and I'm learning more because I'm way more active, and it's just so ingrained in the university. I was like, why are we not doing this in Scotland?
And the people you meet as well while you're traveling, like, you know, the people at the school, they're all similar minded people. You're like, yeah, they want to travel, they want to experience different things. If they weren't the similar type of people, they weren't, you know, they wouldn't be there in the first place. So straight away you've got a connect. It's easier to connect with, oh wow, you found the green school, like, welcome. Like, oh yeah, like, this is what we wanted to achieve. This is what we wanted. Oh yeah, and you're like, everyone's the same. So we met from people from Australia, Netherlands, Texas, from everywhere. It was just a fantastic place to be. We would go, like, school finished early on a Friday afternoon, as is tradition in Bali, and we all the parents would get together and kids get together. We'd go to a pool bar and have sundowners and stuff. So it was cool.
Amazing. Yeah. And what about moving a little bit more onto Bitcoin of like, whilst you were traveling, did you come across Bitcoin at all? Like anywhere accepting Bitcoin or in Bali, I imagine you might have,
Bali has got a big crypto bro community, right? Especially down in Canggu. We were a bit further up in the sort of family oriented area of Ubud. But down in Canggu and Seminyak, so there was a big, there'd be, you know, crypto bro cafes where everyone meets up and like where there'd be a Bitcoin ATM and, you know, they'd do trading seminars, you know, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, we saw Bitcoin ATMs pretty much everywhere. Everywhere we went. And you just think this is mass adoption. I couldn't tell you in the UK where my closest Bitcoin ATM actually is.
It must have been, I want to say 2 years ago now, they banned them. So they had them in multiple places, like around the UK.
And that was for why, because 2 years ago, we were away. So
yeah, exactly. I'm not sure what the regulation, what the regulation was, but it meant that, you couldn't have Bitcoin ATMs anymore.
That's crazy.
So, it's wild now. But I know that they're all over the place outside of the UK.
Completely. The last place we were was the Gold Coast in Australia. And we pulled into this little backcountry town, stopped at the 7-Eleven, and there's a Bitcoin ATM in the 7-Eleven in a like proper backwater little country town in Australia. You're just like, wow.
Everywhere.
Everywhere we saw them. Everywhere.
Well, that's really interesting. Because we're just not used to them here. But what got you, so the reason that you're on is you're interested in Bitcoin, and like, I think like the whole traveling side of things like really aligns with like Bitcoin and like looking forward and having a currency that you can use anywhere in the world, which is hard for a lot of people to get their head around because they're used to like, I'm in this country, so I have to use this. If I go to this country, used to have to exchange it. Whereas you can just use your card now. And use a different currency.
Not in every country.
Surprise,
not in every country. You can't just pay on your card.
I'm talking about primarily like the UK going to Europe and going to America, but it's very different in different places where you still cash is king for a lot of places, unfortunately.
Correct. Even the cash. So say Zimbabwe, for instance, the Zimbabwean dollar is so volatile that there's two different rates for the US dollar rate. So there's a rate in the supermarket that the locals pay, and then there's a black market rate where you collect everyone's cash and like in dollars, and one guy takes it to the government and gets a different rate. Like, and it's just like, this is bonkers. But you can see the prices in the supermarket electronically change. Depending on what the currency is doing, you're just like, it's just gone up like $20 like for a bottle of shower gel. Like, you just like, so Zimbabwe was difficult. We actually had a friend there, and they managed to lend us their bank account. So we put US dollars in, we could spend Zimbabwe dollars using their cards. But it was just so difficult. First 3 weeks we were there, we couldn't go and draw money out of the cash machine. The capital city, Harare, there was only two cash machines where we could actually get cash using a foreign card. The struggles with currency in many places is difficult, but as Bitcoin solves this, right?
Yeah.
Bitcoin solves.
It is wild when you go to these sorts of places and you do realize, like, even when I go to America, you realize like the UK is actually quite far ahead when it comes to like payments than America, because you'll pay for something, they'll take your card away, and then you'll have to sign something. They didn't have contact. I don't know if they have now, because it's been a couple of years since I've been, but I didn't have contactless for a long time. So you do realize how privileged we are here in the UK.
I feel as though we sort of moved on very quickly here in the UK. So from the time we left to the time we got back was just completely different. Right. Little example. So the ice cream van that's parked in the country park, right, where you go for a walk. Before we left, there was no way that you would be able to pay contactless at that ice cream van. Now, no one carries wallets. Like, it's just all on your phone. Everyone's contactless using Apple Pay or GPay or whatever it is. Before we left, we saw that it was just completely different. And the countries that are way ahead, Australia and stuff, people have been doing that for years, before we even got there. But now I feel as though we're catching up to countries like Australia. But it's all about the infrastructure, right? And the technology. Like sum up, just wasn't a thing before we left. And now everyone's got one, right?
Yeah.
Even your local hairdressers, you know, you're traveling, people that are traveling around doing, you know, dog walkers and all sorts. Like everyone's got sum up. You just go, oh, tap them. It's like, that's money. Yeah, and no one ever sees it, right? No one ever sees the it's just numbers on a spreadsheet or numbers on your bank.
And they now won't accept cash as well. Yeah. Cash is getting mostly phased out. So yeah, and now you won't, it's gone very fast from now we won't take contactless.
Yeah.
To now we won't take cash.
Yeah, checks are a thing of the past, right?
Yeah, it is moving fast, like that thing, like, and you have to be able to keep up with it. And you've obviously been keeping up with it. What got you into Bitcoin originally?
I read an article. I was in a hotel room for far-flung corner of the world in Bangladesh, probably Chittagong or somewhere like that in Bangladesh. And I, you know, you have your iPads and laptops. And this is way back when they were heavy and cumbersome devices. I read an article online and it was just like about Bitcoin. I was just like, oh, this is quite interesting. And then obviously as soon as it's piqued your interest, the more things you see, the more things you like. And then you sort of try and educate yourself on Bitcoin. And then after that trip, I went back to the UK and we decided to buy some investment property. And the guy said, just a general question to the guy who was selling it. It's like, good deal. It got decent yield and this and that. I said, well, why are you selling? Pretty legitimate question. Why are you selling? Does it have a, you know, does it flood once a year? You know what I mean? And he was like, no, I'm selling all my portfolio and putting it into Bitcoin.
What year was this?
I bet it was 2015. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that guy's flying. He must be absolutely flying. Unless he's like bought a load of tops and sold a load of bottoms. But I imagine he's flying.
Wow. Yeah. Because from memory, 2015, we were like, you could buy it for like, I want to say like $500. Because that was the first time I bought it.
Cheaper, yeah. I bet it was three. Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. Because I paid $500 in 2015 for one. But I sold it straight away for a fake ID.
Yeah. Yes. There's so many stories in that. But it took me ages to buy. Ages and ages. Just like I didn't really have time this Saturday. Like obviously I was reading about it, I was really interested. I think this is the way that the monetary system eventually will go. We were already going cashless. That was contactless. That was when contactless first came in. I was like, well, actually, you don't see the money in your bank account anyway. We're gonna be just scanning QR codes between each other and mobile wallets and all this sort of stuff. And I just went massively down the rabbit hole and waited another 2 years maybe before I actually bought any. It was at 6K, thought I'd missed it. So I bought it at 6 and then we nuked back down to like, 1,500. And then I've just been round tripping ever since, you know. Every time it hits the low, I just buy some more. And every time but I've bought all this stuff and bought Ethereum at like 300 or something like that.
Nice. Right. Well, rounding off, I've got a couple questions for you. One is, so you don't name any names. But is there any other like cricketers or professional athletes that you know that are holding Bitcoin and like really deep down the rabbit hole, but maybe they just can't come out and say? Like, I'm seeing a lot of things of like, I know behind the scenes a lot of people, like famous people that are buying Bitcoin, held Bitcoin for a long time, but just probably can't come out and say it.
Yeah. No, it's like, it would be on the, I would say that in the sporting community, there it would be as a very similar ratio to what's in wider society, right? Like everyone you talk to is under a little bit of a dabble, right? Like everyone, to a man, pretty much, of my age and the younger guys especially, the ones that have just come out of uni are all over it, right? The guys that are, don't know what they're doing, they just, and they usually start on Pi, right? Because someone's gone, oh, now
that's love it. That.
Download
I used to do that pretty much. Back in the day.
Yeah. Pi coin. Insane. This is.
So much. Just. Yeah.
This is not ridiculous. What ours is working, but you know, they're transacting in that Pi coin in Nigeria and places like that. They really are. So, you know, good.
Okay. Like, if there's a use case for something like, I mean, Peter McCormack got a lot of stick for, I think it was when he went to Argentina and he done his documentary there, and he was saying people aren't, they're not using Bitcoin for transacting. They're using other cryptocurrencies or stable coins for transacting because it's not like, it's better for them to use a different their stable coin or a cryptocurrency. He got so much just stick for that. But if that's what's happening in these countries, they're not as good a store of value, but if they're serving a purpose, then what's the problem with that?
Correct. What is the problem? I mean, like the logical choice for as a means of payment is XRP, right? Logically.
I would argue the Lightning Network coin, but
Lightning Network. See, I've never used the Lightning Network.
Okay. So, we'll do after this, we'll do a transaction.
Yeah, that's fine. You can pay my fee in it for coming on.
Hey, this is Jordan whilst editing. If you want to see the Lightning demonstration, which was really, really cool, as we sent a transaction to El Salvador and back in a matter of seconds, then click the link in the description below, wherever you are listening to this, to see Tim's reaction. Okay, back to the episode.
There's no fees. But XRP is something that worked really well for us while we were traveling. So moving money between wallets and it's rapid, it's cheap as chips, and it just seems to never has an issue. It goes and it does it. You know, the conversion rate from XRP into any currency on the exchanges that we're using is like very easy. It just works. Like, and that's what you want. That's what you want crypto to do, right? Just work. That's what you want money to do. That's what you want technology to do, is just work. Whereas the reason I don't really want to use the Lightning Network, because I don't pay for anything in Bitcoin.
Okay.
I just don't want to do it because I know it's going up. Right?
Yeah.
Stable coins would be different. I guess. You know, there's no point.
But paying for it. The Lightning Network can, I don't know the facts behind, I don't have them off the top of my head, but it's cheaper, as far as I'm aware, cheaper than XRP and faster. But it's still like in its infancy, really. Like, it's only been around for maybe like five, 6 years.
Yeah.
Less than that, maybe. So yeah, it's still getting, it's still evolving, really. But what's getting built on top of Bitcoin? So then there's not going to be a need to, well, there might not be a need to actually come out of that currency.
Yeah.
But as we, nobody really knows what's going to happen in the future.
Well, the way I see it, right, if I was to give you a fiver in, on the Lightning Network in Bitcoin now, in next year, that'll be worth £15. So why would you back to that in an asset that's going to appreciate over time? I just don't understand.
Yeah.
You'd much rather, you know, convert it to a stable coin and transact that way. Like, it just, it hurt less.
Well, that's the mindset.
From all the stuff that you bought, you know, and when it was at the top, that'd be fine. But all stuff when you bought when it was at the bottom, just thinking, I should have bought that when Bitcoin was at the top, and I'd have got so much more. You just like, but I guess if you're a Bitcoin maxi, that's not the way you think, is it? Because all your money's in Bitcoin anyway.
That's the way I think. Because like, it's you've got either way. If you're sending money on Bitcoin or you're sending it on XRP, you're gonna have to convert the same amount of value, the market value at that time, into XRP to then send it on. But I could just send it on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But then it will be more painful because I'm just going to say, like, if XRP goes right down and then Bitcoin's rising as over time, it will be more painful.
hence why stable coins exist, right?
Yeah.
It just hurt me to know that I bought an ice cream over the Bitcoin Lightning Network and I just paid 240 quid for an ice cream like 2 years ago. I'd be like, whist.
That's the thing that people are going to have to get their head around is the whole idea of like, I don't know if you've read Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow, which is all about deflation or moving into a deflationary economy of everyone's used to prices going up, but what happens if they go down? It's such a mindfuck. Anyone listening, I would recommend reading that.
I think I will. Send me the link.
Yeah, I'll send you. It's a phenomenal book. Last question is, what you got going on now? People say, like, in football, now that you've hung up your boots.
Yeah.
And then I wrote that and I was like, nah, that's not right. Is there a phrase in cricket that you say, I put pads?
Well, nah, you do. You do actually say hang up your boots. So you do wear boots. So there is that. So since we got back to traveling, I just, because obviously being retired is boring, right? I found it while we're traveling was great. When we got back, I was just like, well, what am I going to do now? Because all my friends, I can't just hang out with all my friends. Like the kids, we put the kids back in school. And what am I going to fill my days with? It's difficult to say like how much I'm allowed to talk about this because of the FCA regulations. But well, effectively, what we've done is we've set up an investment fund for normal people to get their money to hopefully make some gains, but hopefully educate along the way. And the company's called Boulder Capital. We've got to be careful what I say from FCA regulations and an advertisement point of view, but. That's what we're doing.
Go on. Yeah, you can leave it at that. Awesome. It'd been amazing just to hear your story from professional cricket, like what that was like. Like that blew me away about the like you spent 10 nights in your own bed 1 year.
Yeah,
right? That's mental.
Yeah. When you look back, you think that's like that wouldn't happen today. I don't think. I mean, the guys get a lot more time off and stuff, and But yeah, I mean, mentally, that was mental, right?
I can imagine.
Tough for the family, though. Tough for my wife. We just had our firstborn. And It's basically, going around the world playing cricket. And even when you're at home, you're not at home, you're in some hotel in London or Nottingham or Birmingham or Manchester. Yeah, it's difficult.
Wild.
But the payoffs are, pretty sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. And then it allowed you to then spend that time traveling with your family, the words.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you very much for coming on. And it's been a good chatting to you.
Not a problem. Pleasure.